Well, hello there. Thank you for joining me today. I have, well, a lot of information, and I may do part of it today, and I may do part of it tomorrow. I do not know right now because last I left off talking about the Circassian people. Well, they wound up in Turkey, and I had read a long time ago about a white woman slave trade in Turkey. Turns out it was also including Circassian people as part of the white slave trade going on in Turkey. Circassia, also known as Zica, Zicia, was a country and a historical region in the Northern Caucasus, along the northern shore of the Black Sea. It was conquered by the Russian Empire during the Russo-Circassian War, 1763 to 1864, after which 90% of the Circassian people were either exiled from the region or murdered. Yeah, that whole thing is very, very important to this whole picture. Several things caught my attention about the Circassians. One is that, remember, this whole story is not going to be, oh yeah, this is directly exactly it. There's going to be some twists and turns in here that would have been tossed in along the way to trick this, right? Because I think the very last thing they would ever want anybody to know would be that black people had all of their land stolen, also, because this whole thing is about enslaving us, stealing land, and murder, right? So imagine this, if all the black people in Africa knew that they were there first and they should be the ones in charge, maybe their reaction to the so-called people from Belgium and other countries wearing their royal attire and claiming their land just like that, and then enslaving the population might have been a different story. Or maybe it will become a different story if people realize that, well, they're being oppressed by the people that stole from them, right? What better way to never let anybody find out that you stole their entire identity, their money, their land, than to lock them all up, right? Murder them. The ones you can't murder, you lock up, you beat, you subjugate, you make them all poor. Just look at the history of the blacks in this country. This doesn't take a genius. It's hard to take a look at, right? As a matter of fact, just recently, there was a, let me scroll down here. Just to give you, in case you're not from this area, a little take of what's going on. There was a incident in Chicago. One officer fired at least 50 times during a stop of a person called Dexter Reed, a young black man, okay? And watchdog chief questions whether Chicago cops lied about why they stopped Dexter Reed before killing him in exchange of gunfire. So what happened was, on March the 21st, five tactical officers from the Harrison District approached his car, and he had heavily tinted windows. And they claim, in one report, they said it was because he wasn't wearing his seatbelt. But basically, what happened was they claim that this young person, Reed, took a shot at them, okay? And then the four other officers opened fire. Well, what's interesting about this is that the video showed, and I watched the video showed officers going on to shoot at Reed 96 times in 41 seconds. A lot of gunfire, even if they claim that he shot him, but they always use that claim, right? Well, I saw a handgun there. I just had to shoot to protect myself. Yeah. Well, anyway, so my point in all of this is you want to criminalize your enemy, right? You don't want your enemy knowing that you're living their wealthy life, right? So the last thing you would want all these black people to understand is that this whole model of this game board has been set up by them living off of the backs of the working class by taxing us. They have lived and gained their wealth by stealing major regions of properties. Every event that I've covered so far has, in fact, involved the theft of land. San Francisco earthquake, check. Lots of land got stolen during that fake earthquake. So every event has on the back end some effort to either murder people or steal their land, which makes it interesting because they have black people in this country shoved off to the corner, most of them in places like Mississippi. They don't hardly have water to drink. So I guess the plan is keep them poor, keep them stupid about their actual heritage. I didn't say they were stupid people. I said keep them stupid about their heritage. You know, who knows? You know, remember Black Wall Street got mowed down from the air by planes. Why exactly in the 20s did the U.S. fly planes over Oklahoma in an area called Black Wall Street and using incendiary bombs blow out that area? I did a show about it. So why that particular part of this country did they blow away? And that would have been a specific part of Oklahoma being Black Wall Street. Was that crowd getting wise to what was going on? Don't know, but there's a lot of twists and turns, right? So the effort has to be to keep black people poor and ignorant to what their history is, right? So today I'm going to be talking more about Columbus and the deal with India today. And next, then I will follow with the Circassians. So, I have a couple things to say first. this is a good one. You know, everybody is talking about AI. Well, I did a show about AI. AI is handy, like ChatGPT. I used it quite a bit on a specific part of this show today. It's very handy when you're gathering up all these bits of stuff instead of going around to the different encyclopedias and places, right? Because you can say, okay, tell me more about the Russo-Caucasian War, and they will give you a bunch of links to different things, right? It saves a great deal of time from me having to hunt around to all these different locations to get an overview. I use it for overview, right? So, but it doesn't think for me. It doesn't, you know. So they're talking about AI is going to be wiping out the world, right? Well, it's just a big lie like the rest of them, right? And this one was kind of funny. Amazon, you know, they said that they had those shopping carts that you could put your stuff in and it would keep track of things and then you just cruise out the door. Well, Amazon had to admit that the AI things at their grocery store was totally fake. And what it was, when you were pushing your cart around, I guess it would be Whole Foods, when you're pushing your cart around one of these stores and putting things into it, you know, you have a screen there and stuff. Well, that was attached to a group in India. Speaking of India. So it really wasn't keeping track of your groceries. A worker from India was logged on at the same time and putting, you know, to making sure the charges were correct in your basket. So it was a complete and utter big lie. So, and that's what you do. You come up with such fantastic lies that, hey, we've been to space a couple of times. So, and you can also, when you come up with these big lies, You can probably figure that, just like with the vaccine, you can probably figure that you can get about half the population to believe your lies, right? So, and that's what happens when we just don't hold them accountable, which is a different subject for a different day. So anyhow, so yes, if you're going to steal from somebody, you certainly don't want them wise to what you've been doing, right? So your efforts through your history and stuff would be to make sure your his story would be their story, not your story, right? So yeah, so there's a lot about this story that I think we need to really question, like, were the Circassian people really into paganism? It's starting to sound more like the oh, I don't know, the Roman Catholics, right? So, you know, the Circassians also seem to have a history of getting kicked out of places. Well, I don't know. So did the Jews, right? So did the Jesuits. So, and I'm not saying that maybe Circassians didn't deserve to get kicked out, but I'm just saying, as I'm going through this data with you, just be thinking about the patterns here, right? Because the Circassians definitely got wiped out. They definitely ended up in Turkey. And it's an interesting story between the Turkish and the Armenians. So I just may have to tackle that later. Another offshoot of what I've been up to is, you know, regardless of if you think it was crazy when I've talked about our bodies are electricity, electricity is the way they're harming us right now. Just think about this, okay? They also use electricity as murder weapons against us. How do they do that? Well, we have things like stun guns, which are electrical charges. There's all kinds of ways they zap us, tasers. I have a whole file about it. But anyway, so electric chairs. So, you know, they supposedly execute prisoners in electric chairs. So, yeah, just something for you to think about today. One other detail. East Palestine, Ohio, they got a settlement from Norfolk Southern. I can't help but wonder, you know, I'm in Norfolk, Nebraska. All of the spooks and creeps are over in Norfolk, Virginia. Hello, CIA. Hello, NATO. They're over in Norfolk, Virginia, but they did agree to a class action lawsuit and they awarded $600 million. The lead attorneys representing the victims said the settlement would be the largest in U.S. rail history. Yes, keep focusing on that because the multi-million dollar deal still needs final approval from the district attorney or something like that. But anyway, so the attorneys met with reporters and said that we think this is an outstanding result. But here's the kicker. It will take a while for residents and businesses to get money. The attorney said it would take several months to finalize the settlement and determine an allocation formula for the money. The settlement would cover all residents as well as businesses, ding, 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 that can prove loss affected by the derailment within a 20-mile radius. Well, we all know that this went much farther than the 20-mile radius, right? But here's the tricks in here, right? The attorneys, now I haven't seen the fee structure the attorneys are charging these residents, but I'm going to guess I did sue Intel, so I have a thing or two about attorneys. And when I was suing Intel, I had to go through a few attorneys, and greed was the only name of that game, right? And in the end, they always say, oh, we'll do it on consignment. Well, not really, because you have to upfront thousands of dollars that they put into an account. So anytime they lift a finger to file anything, that comes out of your account. So it's not like they just sue them for free and then you settle up at the end, right? So they basically will take at least 40% of that settlement after you have paid all the out-of-pocket expenses. Now, was that this agreement? I don't know. But what I'm saying is, what surprised me about this settlement, well, it didn't surprise me, but the issues that I have with it is this. First of all, they come up with this $600 million fee, and they haven't figured out how the settlement will be determined, like how allocation formulas will work, right? So, what's this going to be? A big pitting neighbors against neighbors to get their hands on the money? And here's the other thing: part of the settlement is opt-in and frees Norfolk Southern from future claims. The attorney said the settlement will allow residents and businesses to opt in. So what that means is that if you decide to make some other claim or whatever, you can go ahead and do that. But if you want to claim some of this money, if a person files a claim, they could not sue Norfolk again if new health issues arrive from the derailment or toxic burn. Keep in mind, Norfolk Southern, on purpose, it has been found to be on purpose, set up a huge, massive, toxic mess for all those people. 600 million hardly cuts the deal, right? Norfolk Southern, their statement was the company made a commitment. Yeah, okay. They said that the Atlanta-based company issued, and why aren't people outside of this company day and night? The Atlanta-based company issued a statement on Tuesday after the settlement was announced. It described the deal, and listen to this, as another promise kept by Norfolk Southern for the East Palestine community. Well, gotta tell you, there's never a good deal when you deal with psychopaths. I've had firsthand experience. And actually, I'm not bitter about what happened when I had to sue Intel because that event led me to where I am today. Obviously, it led me to a direction that didn't have the big money income from living in Silicon Valley. Overnight, I went from $120 consulting fees to $10 working as a temporary person when I decided to sue Intel. I am a person, once I make up my mind, I will keep moving forward. So, yeah, my billing rate as a consultant in Silicon Valley was $120 an hour for my consulting fees as a trade show consultant. When I decided to sue Intel, I had to get temporary work. My opening rate at the temp agency was $10 an hour. I took a $110 an hour pay cut to sue Intel, and I am glad for every minute. It was very difficult raising that huge amount of money the attorneys needed for all that stuff. It was extremely, extremely difficult. But you know what? Set your mind to it. Set your mind to it. So anyway, so yeah, so good luck, Palestine. I feel I have great sympathy for you. And just remember, there's ways that you can medically, with marijuana and stuff, deal with things. Because if you head into the medical system, and this is your own decision, but you might want to review the tricks down the road because any treatments will accelerate your disease. So let me keep moving along. So for today, we're going to be talking about the Moors. What about the Moors? Well, interestingly enough, you should ask. the Moors, I should open up by saying, have dark skin, right? As a matter of fact, I've been all hung up on this hat. I need to keep my reputation as a hat expert. When I was a kid, I would have been like 9 years old or so, about 1962 era. My father was stationed in Spain, and we would have gone to Morocco. And that was where I first encountered the Fez hat. That's Fez hat. That's that red hat. And I have a lot about that Fez hat today. So I first encountered the Fez hat there because, as I remember, the people working in the restaurants and stuff all wore the Fez hat. Okay. So, anyhow, so I have a lot about the Fez hats, but what I have for the show today is I do have a link. I talked a couple of shows ago about what's going on with me here in my house. And I had read a couple of stories in a show, and one of the stories I can't find because my computer, but anyway, so there's one article called Madness in Madison County, and I live in Madison County. Norfolk, Nebraska is in Madison County, Nebraska. Okay. So it's an article, Madness in Madison County, and it talks about one specific murder of a woman that has been unsolved. And it's been unsolved because of the cast of characters running things. I've spoken in the past, the whole structure was this setup. Every town was started with a preacher, a doctor, and a sheriff, right? So that, because I've been talking about in the last show that I did as far as the CIA and the Catholic Church, right? Actually, the doctor, the sheriff, and the other person actually set up like our own little spy network within all of our towns, right? That's how we got the people that are ruling all of these towns right now. That same pattern was replicated. And it makes a great deal of sense because people confide in the preacher and the doctor, right? No one would think it weird if your preacher said, "Well, you know, if you want to get your kid to be the chosen one, wink, wink, nod, nod, there are certain things that can be done so your child will be ahead of the other children as the chosen one," and start to introduce the idea of transgendering the children, right? So it gets introduced by the wink, wink, nod, nod. One of them, it could be the doctor or the priest, right? The local town, right? So then everybody in that town would know who'd have the treatment, right? So, yeah, it's set up almost like a CIA involvement in all of our small towns. So, anyway, so this article is interesting because what happens in this small town is no different than all small towns. The one person who's the prosecutor, whose name is Joe Smith, they call him a county attorney. If you get arrested in Madison County for anything, okay? In order for the cops to bring charges against you, Joe Smith has to approve the charges. So, pretty powerful position, right? And that same person was in charge of, in 2002, they had a major, major psyops in this area. They claimed it was a bank robbery, and I've talked about it so much in the past, I'm not going to go into it now. But what I'm saying is that was how these structures were set up and then replicated across the country. And they did it quite efficiently because remember, for a long time, people could not travel because they were rolling out the old technology, right? So they conveniently did not introduce cars until trains had essentially moved a lot of the people and stuff into the other parts of this country. So the only way most people could get to other parts of this country would be by train or, obviously wagon train, but that I doubt that that was as popular as a train ride would be, right? So most people got transported by trains, which completely controlled how the population got distributed. It also controlled how all these towns got set up along those train tracks, right? Just show me one Western story that doesn't have a town sheriff and a town cop and a town preacher featured. Basically, every Western movie I can remember watching as a kid, they all had those three characters, right? And I've said before, they wrote the script, they write the Bible, then from that, they spin off the stories, right? So, one purpose script writing. You write this story about the cowboys in this country, And you're really, in many ways, showing us that it was being run by the sheriffs, the doctors. You see what I'm saying? So that has essentially been the structure. So anyway, so back to today. So I have some links down below. First link is the Moors were Muslims of Arab and Berber descent who lived in North Africa and Spain. Berber and Arab DNA in Europe from the Moorish occupation. Somebody has been doing some DNA about these Moors. Now, in order to connect all of these dots, they're doing Berber and Arab DNA in Europe, okay? What would be interesting if there was ever any Moorish DNA found in the United States, right? And I also have, which will be my feature today, the Fez hat and its purpose. 13 things you should know. And slavery in the Ottoman Empire. I think I'll be covering that with the other group. But anyway, so let's keep moving along here. So let me see here. Let's first talk about Columbus and get this straight in our heads, right? Because I'm 72 years old. I was a little fuzzy about what they told us. So Columbus was from Spain, right? We had the Murano Jews were also from Spain, the Spanish region, right? So now we got Columbus in Spain. And 1492, around the time we're looking at, right? Because with all this quantum stuff, my guess is they've tricked 100 or 200 years in here somewhere, okay? Just do the basic math and you can figure it out. And anybody, there were a couple of people who've done shows about how they tricked it, and I could not trace them down, and I tried. So, anyhow, so 1492. Christopher Columbus, CC, his name itself means 33, their specific number, right? Who worked for the Spanish royals, sailed across the Atlantic, and accidentally discovered America. Vasco da Gama, representing the Portuguese king, went around Africa and discovered India. Okay, so now we got. In the same time frame, Christopher Columbus, or 33, was cruising around, got lost, and discovered America. One part of the story I read that he was actually going to look for India, but let's just stick with what I could find right now because. So 1492, Christopher Columbus accidentally discovers America, okay? 1498, which was only 6 years later. This Vasco da Gama, representing the Portuguese king, went around Africa and discovered India. Okay, so that's how those two groups were circling around. Supposedly, Columbus found America and Portugal found India, right? So I was asking all these questions. Was Christopher Columbus sailing to India? No, Christopher Columbus never actually reached India. In 1492, he set sail from Spain in search of a sea route to Asia, but instead he landed in what is now known as the Americas. What route did Christopher Columbus take? And this is interesting because you'll see a lot of black people along this route. Okay, he traveled primarily to the Caribbean, including the Bahamas, Cuba, Santo Domingo, and Jamaica. And in his latter two voyages, traveled to the coasts of Central America and Northern South America. Because I've long said that there was just a lot of gray areas, right? Because we had all those people over in Haiti, and then there were all those movement of black people over into Texas, because at one time Galveston was the huge center. So at one point they built up Galveston with all these black people who didn't get routed anywhere. They got routed straight from here direct. So it's been kind of a mess to kind of keep track of. And interestingly enough, after all these black people helped build Galveston, they just so happened to have that big earthquake or flood. I'm just tired today. But anyway, so let me keep moving here. So Christopher Columbus mainly went to these what appear to be African countries, right? The Caribbean, Bahamas, Cuba. Okay. Who discovered the sea route of Africa? The correct answer is Bartholomew Dias. Bartholomew Dias discovered the Cape of Good Hope, the maritime route to Africa. Okay, so, but Valentin Dias was a Portuguese mariner and explorer. He was the first European navigator who discovered the Cape of Good Hope in 1488. So Portugal found that part of Africa, supposedly, right? When was sea route to India discovered? At the same time, Indian resources were in great demand in European countries. These factors pushed the Europeans to discover a new sea route to India. Vasco da Gama, the Portuguese sailor, finally found the sea route to India in 1498. Who found America before Columbus was my question. Meanwhile, on the eastern shores of the Americas, the most certain, best documented evidence for European contact with America before Columbus is the Vikings. Icelandic sagas record that Leif Erikson took a ship west from Greenland in the year 1001 and set up a settlement in an area they called Vinland. Why did Columbus want to find India? Columbus wanted to find a new route to India, China, Japan, and the Spice Islands. If he could reach these islands, he could bring back rich cargoes of silks and spices. Who discovered North America first? The voyages of Christopher Columbus opened the New World. That's where we keep getting this idea that this is the New World, right? All you'd have to do would be to flip around a bunch of data. When you mirror things, this has all been mirrored, right? So, like for example, they use that Gothic architecture, right? Well, then you find new Gothic architecture and old, you see what I'm saying? And I think the reason they do that is because that way they could always say, oh no, that was the new Gothic, right? You're confused. That's not the old Gothic. When in reality, it's just one Gothic. So the voyages of Christopher Columbus opened the New World. Italian navigator and explorer Giano Caboto, known in English as John Cabot, is credited with the discovery of continental North America on June the 24th, 1497, under the commission of Henry the 7th of England. So they're now saying that an Italian navigator known as John Cabot discovered continental North America, and they were commissioned by Henry the 7th of England, right? How far did Columbus think India was? Because remember, he got lost supposedly, right? When Columbus set sail, he carried a passport from his patrons, Ferdinand and Isabel of Spain, stating in Latin that he represented them on his voyage out partes India towards the regions of India. Columbus thought the distance from the Canary Islands to Japan was about 2,760 miles, when in fact, I don't know, it's something else, but what was India called in 1492? This is interesting. In 1492, there was no country known as India. Instead, that country was called Hindustan. I think that is closer to the truth than the Spanish padre that sailed with Columbus was so impressed with the innocence of the natives, he observed what he called them los niños en Dios. That means the children in God. So it was called Hindustan, Hindustan. And then I wanted to know, how long did it take? The reason you ask a whole bunch of different questions like this is because then you'll start to find discrepancies, right? Okay, so how long did it take Columbus to find India? And remember, so Columbus sailed from Palos de la Frontera on Friday, August the 3rd, 1492, reached the Canary Islands 6 days later and stayed there for a month to finish outfitting his ships. He left on September the 6th, and 5 weeks later, in about the place he expected, he found the Indies. What else could it be but the Indies? And then I had a question, did Africans discover America? And this is where it gets crazy, right? In fact, evidence shows that West Africans have sailed across the Atlantic Ocean to the Americas at least 180 years before Christopher Columbus. So we're getting to admit that some Africans were there, right? So who are these Moors? Moors are a member of a Northwest African Muslim people of mixed Berber and Arab descent. In the 8th century, they conquered the Iberian Peninsula. That's where Spain is. So in the 8th century, they conquered the Iberian Peninsula, but were finally driven out after their last stronghold in Granada at the end of the 15th century. So see what we're talking about? They got run out, right? Remember we had those Jews, there was that special hidden group of crypto Jews. The crypto Jews were in Spain. They didn't want to become Christians, so they were hiding out in Spain before they got kicked out. The term Moor has a complex history and varied meaning. The word Moor is believed to have originated from the Phoenician term Maharin, which meant Westerners. From Maharin, M-A-H-U-R-I-N, the ancient Greeks derived Maro, M-A-U-R-O, and Latin later adopted Mari, M-A-U-R-I. The term Moor was first used by Christian Europeans to describe Muslim populations in the Iberian Peninsula, Sicily, and Malta during the Middle Ages. So now we've got the Moors at an area our alarm bells should be going off, right? Because we find the Moors in Sicily and Malta, right? Diverse identity. Moors are not a single, distinct, or self-defined people. Europeans of the Middle Ages applied the name to Arabs, Berbers, and Muslim Europeans. The term has been used more broadly in Europe to refer to Muslims in general, especially those of Arab or Berber descent, whether living in Al-Andalus or North Africa. During the colonial era, the Portuguese introduced the names Ceylon, C-E-Y-L-O-N Moors, and Indian Moors in South Asia, and Bengali Muslims were also called Moors. So we first find them introduced during the colonial era. And the Portuguese introduced Indian Moors, right, in South Asia and Bengali. Muslims were also called Moors. See how they're getting to be kind of a vague group of people. It could be kind of anybody, right? So, in the Iberia Peninsula, which is Spain, the Moors played a significant role in creating the Islamic Andalusian civilization in Spain and Portugal. They settled there between the 11th and 17th century. Sicily. The Moors occupied Mazara, Mazara, on Sicily and eventually consolidated the rest of the island. North Africa, the Maghreb, Maghreb region saw the influence of Moorish culture and civilization. Maurita and Mati, the term Moor designates the predominant Arab ethnic group in Mauritia and small Arab minority in Mati. Depictions and ethnic characteristics. From the Middle Ages to the 17th century, Europeans often depicted Moors as being black, swarmy, or tawny in skin color. Despite this, the population in most parts of North Africa differs little in physical appearance from that of Southern Europe. So, what they're saying is the population, despite that, in most parts of North Africa differs little in physical appearance from that of Southern Europe. The term Moorish, 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 continues to describe the art, architecture, and high culture of Muslim Andalusia and North Africa from the 11th century onward. In summary, the term Moor has a rich and multifaceted history encompassing various ethnicities, regions, and cultural contributions. It does not have a single fixed definition, and its usage has evolved over time. So interesting, it's evolving over time, kind of like that Bible, right? Subject to change. Okay, so who was, remember in, and this is all over in that region, right? Remember Soleimani, that was a guy from Iran that was supposedly shot down by drone under Trump. Trump planned this drone attack on an Iranian general. His name was Soleimani. Okay. Interestingly enough, and excuse me, let me finish that story. So, anyway, so supposedly this guy is at an airport, Soleimani person, and Trump orders a drone to take him out. Well, it was a fake murder, right? Because it, well, a lot of reasons. But anyhow, so the guy really wasn't dead. It was obvious to me within 2 seconds he wasn't dead. But anyway, so people think that he was dead. But what's interesting is this is I want to give you some history of the Ottoman Empire because that's where we're going to be circling back to. Because the Ottoman Empire was what is now present day Turkey, okay? This is where we're going to start to really circle the drain here, okay? Who ran the Ottoman Empire? There was a person called Suleiman the Magnificent, or Suleiman. One was the longest serving sultan of the Ottoman Empire. He reigned from 1520 to 1566 and successfully led over approximately 25 million citizens. He was one of the most important monarchs, and keep track of all this. He was one of the most important monarchs in European history, and under his rule, his armies conquered Hungary, Iraq, and several ports in North Africa. In fact, during Soleimani's reign, the Ottoman Empire controlled a large portion of Africa, Asia, and Europe. Okay. So Soleiman was also nicknamed the lawmaker as he implemented major changes to education, foreign affairs, taxation, and criminal law. His era as ruler is often called the Golden Age of the Ottoman Empire. What I'm suggesting at this point, because I don't want to bury the lead, hold on 1 second here. is something happened, something big happened right at the juncture of the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottoman Empire went down during World War I, and I think that's a juncture point, but I need to keep going through this because otherwise it would become confusing. Because then when I circle back to Russia and all those people got shipped over to Turkey, see how it starts to kind of make more sense. But anyway, so we need this background though. So I was wondering, because I read a few years ago that there is a white female slave trade in Turkey during the Ottoman Empire. And that's what had logged into my brain, right? So my question was there a slave trade, female slave trade? And here's what these are some of the things that ChatGPT is very good for. Yes, the Ottoman Empire, which is modern day Turkey, had a market for female slaves known as Arvet Pazlan or female slave bazaar. This market operated from the mid 15th century to the early 20th century. So it didn't really close down until right around this whole juncture of World War I, right? Many households owned female slaves, employing them as domestic servants. The Ottoman state regulated the slave market and imposed taxes on every slave transaction. Women were captured from diverse African, Asian, and European regions and traded in Istanbul markets. In contrast to male slaves, women were often subject to sexual exploitation, with their sexuality considered the personal property of their owners. Female slaves were frequently value-based on physical attributes like beauty and entertaining skills, especially when chosen by elite men as slaves or concubines. Slaves were sold to both commoners and the elite, including members of the imperial palace. However, it's important to note that the Turkish media often overlooks non-elite or common women in slavery, instead focusing more on the relatively privileged slaves in the Ottoman imperial harem. It is also noteworthy that the Ottoman Empire adopted practices akin to those of other slave societies, particularly preceding Islamic states. And slavery was governed by a common legal framework rooted in Islamic law. In conclusion, the Ottoman Empire did have a market for female slaves, and those women came from various regions, including Europe. However, the term white is a modern construct and may not accurately reflect the complex realities of race and ethnicity during the Ottoman period. So then I was asking questions. So one of my questions was about the Circassians. The answer was yes, Circassians were indeed among the groups that were enslaved in the Ottoman Empire, which includes modern day Turkey. Circassians originated from the Caucasus region, were often prized for their beauty, and were frequently enslaved, then sold to the Ottoman Empire. They were particularly prominent in the so-called luxury slave trade route, which provided elite slaves to the Ottoman Empire and the Middle East. During the early 1860s, after the Russian conquest of the region of the Caucasus, nearly 500,000 Circassians migrated to Turkey. Many Circassian women were sold into slavery. This trade in Circassian slaves, particularly women, continued until the 20th century. So, a couple of things here. I'm just going to be throwing out things for us as a group to be thinking about. The Circassians, And I have a lot more about them later. But if we can say that maybe a lot of people in the Ottoman Empire were darker skinned, right? I'm just making some guesses here. So let's say Ottoman Empire, because we're talking Africa, right? So we're talking that area, that region, right? Dark skinned people. And if you look at different faces in the area, what you'll see is difference in the noses, right? The more African, probably the wider bridge your nose is going to be. So we got darker skinned people. So did these Circassians get brought in? Well, because they needed a place to do with them, right? Because they had to leave their land, and I'll get into that later, but were they used to whiten up the territory, right? So were the Circassians, being whiter skinned, introduced to a darker skinned group? Was that to whiten up the citizenry, right? Because I think the trick is to take the people who founded everything, who were dark skinned, and the trick is to convince everybody that no, it was really the white skinned people that really should rule, because white skinned people figured it all out. And after all, aren't we just the smartest ones? Because look at our white skin, right? So that would be a pretty good trick, and it would also make a great deal of sense, right? Because then they would have this whiter population, which would be more like the whiter population coming out of Europe, right? So there's just a lot to consider. So, did they use those women to whiten up the darker skin? Could be a possibility. So, let me keep reading here. So, it says it is important to note that the term Circassian refers to a specific ethnic group from the Caucasus region. The Ottoman Empire enslaved a variety of ethnic groups. Here are some of them. Caucasians, people from the Caucasus region, including Circassians, were often enslaved and sold in the Ottoman Empire. Eastern Europeans, the Ottomans enslaved people from Eastern Europe, including Slavs and others. Southern Europe, people from Southern Europe, including Greeks and others, were also enslaved. Starts to sound like they're pretty important people, aren't they? Starting to sound like, I don't know, Jesuits, right? Southern Europeans, people from Southern Europe, including Greeks and others, were also enslaved. Southeast Europeans, this includes people from the Balkans, such as Bosnians and Albanians. Africans, the Ottomans enslaved people from various regions of Africa. Excuse me. This included people from the Sahara region who were mostly owned by Muslims and were therefore considered Muslim. Central Asia, Central Asian people, including Turkic groups, were also among the enslaved. So yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like it was a just a huge potpourri of enslaved people from all over the place. Now, why is that? Why was that? Because they were doing some sort of experiment to then generate different ethnicities, right? Like they took white people and they made them Chinese people. Did they turn black people and made them Mexican? You see what I'm saying? Is this the boiling pot? Was Turkey the boiling pot? Could be, right? Part of the thing is just kind of going over things and just seeing what floats to the top of your head, right? For centuries, large vessels on the Mediterranean relied on European galley slaves supplied by Ottoman and Barbary slave traders. Hundreds of thousands of Europeans were captured by Barbary pilots and sold as slaves in North Africa and the Ottoman Empire between 16th and 19th century. So, who were all these Europeans that were captured? Were they white? during the height of the Barbary slave trade in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, the Barbary states were subject to Ottoman jurisdiction, with the exception of Morocco, were ruled by Ottoman pashas. It's P-A-S-H-A-S. So why did they carve out Morocco, right? Furthermore, many slaves captured by the Barbary corsairs were sold eastward into Ottoman territories before, during, and after Barbary's period of Ottoman rule. While most of the slave raids occurred in the Western Mediterranean, some raiders plundered as far north as Ireland, the Faroe Islands, and Iceland. It's important to note that the Ottoman Empire's system of slavery was complex and multifaceted, involving various ethnic, religious, and social groups. The main source of slaves were wars and politically organized enslavement expeditions. Slavery was a significant part of the Ottoman Empire's economy and traditional society. What does this sound like? Sounds to me like the United States, right? Circassian, Syrians, and Nubians were the three primary races of female who were sold as sex slaves. Okay, that was Circassians, Syrians, and Nubians. Circassian girls were described as fair and light-skinned and were frequently enslaved and sold to Ottoman Empire. They were the most expensive, the most popular with the Turks. Second in popularity were Syrian girls, which came largely from coastal regions in Anatolia. Their price could reach up to 30 pounds, but remember, the white girls from Circassia got 500 pounds, okay? So the girls from Syria got 30 pounds, big difference. Nubian girls were the cheapest and least popular, fetching up to 20 pounds. Sex roles and symbolism in Ottoman society functioned as a normal action of power. The palace harem excluded enslaved women from the rest of society. So then the Ottoman Empire and 16 other countries signed the 1890 Brussels Conference. And what else was going on about that time? Well, I don't know. What about carving up Africa at that time? So right at the same time, that was the Berlin Conference that they carved up Africa, right? Well, I'm just going off the top of my head. That was, in fact, late 1800s. Okay, so we don't need to get too picky here, right? So the Ottoman Empire and 16 other countries signed the 1890 Brussels Conference Act for the suppression of the slave trade. Clandestine slavery persisted into the early 20th century. A circular by the Ministry of Internal Affairs in October 1895 warned local authorities that some steamships stripped Zanjan sailors of their certificates of liberation and threw them into slavery. Another circular of the same year reveals that some newly freed Zanji, Zanji slaves were arrested based on unfounded accusations, imprisoned, and forced back to their lords. Well, that's going on right now. People, when they supposedly freed the slaves in the United States, they had that exception. What was the exception? Well, right there, we all missed it, right? It stated very clearly that you are a citizen of the United States, except if you are convicted of a crime within the court system, then all things are thrown out the window and you revert to slavehood. That is how most U.S. corporations actually employ prison labor to do their work. That's why the U.S. always runs around screaming about China using prison labor, because every major company pretty much uses the U.S. prison system because it is, in fact, an extension of slavery, just with that one tricky exception. So let me keep going here. So, let me see. So then I was wondering, what was going on with the lawyers in the Ottoman Empire, right? The Ottoman Empire did have lawyers and jurists. The legal system of the Ottoman Empire was a complex one with different sets of laws coexisting. Let me see here. Sultanic law is sultanic, not satanic. Sultanic law coexisted with religious law, mainly the Hanafi school, Hanafi school of Islamic jurisprudence. The Ottoman Empire had three court systems, one for Muslims, one for non-Muslims, and the trade court. The Islamic courts were the empire's primary courts, and they could also be used to settle a trade conflict between different religions. So, they have a pretty aggressive court system, which is another big clue, right? In the late Ottoman state, the Foreign Ministry's Office of Legal Counsel employed a small group of international lawyers. These lawyers played a crucial role in the administration of the empire's legal system. I was just kind of probing. And then I was wondering about the religious. Yes, Roman Catholics were present in the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire had a diverse religious landscape, and it included a significant number of Christians, among them Roman Catholics. Under the Ottoman Empire's millet system, Christians and Jews were considered protected. Under Ottoman law, in exchange for loyalty to the state and payment of this tax, this system allowed non-Muslim communities, including Roman Catholics, to maintain their religious, culture, and legal traditions. So, if you wanted to be a Christian or a Jew, you just were loyal to the state and you paid more tax. After the fall of Constantinople in 1453, the only large Latin Catholic group to be incorporated into the Sultan's domain were the Genoese, who lived in Galta, across the Golden Horn from the Byzantine capital. It's important to note that the relationship between the Ottoman Empire and its Christian subjects, including Roman Catholics, was complex and evolved over time. So, Roman Catholics were able to practice their faith. They had freedom of religion and all that stuff. So that starts to give a little bit more evidence, right? They had educational activities. A congregation of the Roman Catholic conducted education activities in the Ottoman Empire from 1863 to 1914. These activities aimed to enculturate the Christian communities of the Ottoman Empire, achieve union with Rome, and build a bridge of knowledge between Ottoman Orient and Europe. 1863 to 1914, they're getting education, right? Funny how that works, right? Bring in those historians. So, they have several notable churches there. So the Ottoman Empire was a diverse, lots of different Catholics. This is a general overview of the religious composition. They had Islam was the dominant religion of the Ottoman Empire. The majority of the population was Muslim, including both Sunni and Shia. Orthodox Christians were the largest non-Muslim group. This included Greek Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, and other Eastern Orthodox communities. Roman Catholics. There were Roman Catholics in the Ottoman Empire, but they were not as numerous as Orthodox Christians. So, Jews, has significant Jewish population. It sounds to me like it was also, it's important to note that the Ottoman Empire was known for its relative religious tolerance during a period when religious conflicts were prevalent in many parts of Europe. Well, the religion is starting to sound to me more like a melting pot also, right? So now you got all these different ethnic groups converging at this particular time. And then, of course, we have the famous Armenian Genocide. The Armenian Genocide took place in the Ottoman Empire during World War I, because the Ottoman Empire, right around that World War I period, was still in the picture, okay? The Armenian Genocide was a systematic destruction of the Armenian people and identity in the Ottoman Empire during World War I. Typical, right? Keep them busy over there with World War I. They're murdering over here, conducting the Armenian Genocide. It was implemented primarily through the mass murder of around 1 million Armenians during death marches to the Syrian desert and the forced Islamization of others, primarily women and children. The genocide took place from 1915 to 1917. However, massacres and ethnic cleansings of Armenian survivors continued through the Turkish War of Independence, which was after World War I. Who were the perpetrators? The genocide was spearheaded by the Ruling Committee of Union and Progress of the Ottoman Empire, or the CUP. Casualties. The numbers of Armenians who died during the genocide is estimated to be between 600,000 and 1.5 million. As of 2023, 34 countries have recognized the events as genocide, concurring with the academic consensus. See how we're always tied to their academic consensus or their lawyers? Notice a little bit of a pattern here. However, the Turkish government maintains that the deportation of Armenians was a legitimate action that cannot be described as genocide. The motivations behind the Armenian genocide were complex. Okay, so they say it was nationalization and Turkification. Religion differences. The Ottoman rulers, who were Muslim, subjected Armenians, whom they viewed as infidels, to unequal and unjust treatment. Christians paid higher taxes than Muslims, for example, and had few political or legal rights. Economic factors. Now, this is where we start to see why the Armenians had to go, right? The redistribution of property provided an incentive for large numbers of ordinary people to join in the assault on their neighbors. Armenians tended to be better educated and wealthier than their Turkish neighbors, who in turn grew to resent their success. Gee, we're starting to sound like, oh, I don't know, every conflict is going, right? Rwanda, get the Tutsi, get everybody to hate everybody else. It's always about, and that is the beauty of psychopaths, because if they get everybody to hate each other, there's a lot less that they have to do, right? They just have to keep sparking the flames. So they also had political loyalty, the Ottoman rulers grew suspicious that the Christian Armenians would be more loyal to the Christian governments, that of the Russians, for example, who shared an unstable border with Turkey, than they were to the Ottoman group. Hold that thought in your head when I get back to these Caucasian people. Okay, wartime radicalization. Historians generally have explained that Turkish deportations and massacres of the Armenians during the First World War as a result of conflicting ideologies, religion, or nationalists as the understandable and justified response of the Young Turk to Armenian. Anyway, so what they're saying is conflict of ideology, religious, and it's understandable, right? Well, just zoom in on the facts, okay? The facts are this: the Armenians tended to be better educated and wealthier than their Turkish neighbors, who grew to resent their success. So now they kind of brush them off as, well, we didn't like their ideology, and their religion was a problem, right? So yeah, we can justify wiping them out. It's important that these motivations are not mutually exclusive and often overlap. This is what ChatGPT said. The Armenian genocide was a tragic event in history, and understanding its causes requires a nuanced understanding. Yes. Not really that nuanced when you understand what's behind it, right? Murder and theft. So then I was looking into the there was a couple firsts that came out of Armenia. The majority of Armenians are Christians and are members of the Armenian Apostolic Church, which is one of the oldest Christian churches. It was founded in the first century AD. And in 301 AD, Armenia became the first nation in the world to declare Christianity as its state religion. So that's a pretty big deal that Armenia became the first nation in the entire world to declare Christianity as its state religion. As of 2011, about 97% of Armenians in Armenia were Christians. So there are a small amount of Armenians who belong to the Armenian branch of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, gee, that's surprising, huh? Other minority religions and blah, 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 Jehovah's Witnesses, blah, blah, blah. Okay, it's important to note that the landscape in Armenia is diverse, right? Christianity spread to Armenia through a combination of religious, political, and cultural factors. So they were early into the Christianity. They had the royal support with the support of the royal family, another suspicious flag, right? They were the first Christian nation in the world. Pretty big deal, right? The spread of Christianity in Armenia was a significant event in the country's history. So I am going to do this. I'm going to keep scrolling around here because some of these th this stuff you could let's just leave it to rest right there, okay, with these Armenians and stuff for now. And this stuff will tie in with the rest of Circassian. Let's get to the hat business. So I mentioned earlier that I was introduced to fez cats hats as a young child, and I also let me see I also ran across fez hats in the last couple years. Can't remember the subject, but I was looking into this group, which is part of the group they call the Freemasons and stuff, right? There's a group called the Shriners. The Shriners is a group of people, and I have more information about them that I'll get into later, but I remember the Shriners Why do I remember the Shriners? Well, because they wear a fez cat. See, let me sit up here a second. Because I remember that the Shriners wore fez hats. Then we have to stop to ask ourselves, well, why would the Shriners, who are in fact a Freemason group, and I have more information about the Shriners to come here in a minute, why would their official hat be the fez hat? Okay, so fez hats were traditionally worn in Turkey and were a symbol of Ottoman culture. So why would the Freemason people running this charity for children, amongst other kind of suspicious activities, why would they be wearing fez hats? And fez hats were a symbol of Ottoman culture, okay? The fez hat, also known as a tarboosh, Tarboosh, is a cylindrical headwear that was commonly worn by men in the Ottoman Empire. It was made of red felt, and had a tassel attached to its top. The fez hat became an integral part of Ottoman dress code and was worn by people from all walks of life, including soldiers, bureaucrats, and religious figures. And if you're wondering, how did I get to start to call myself a hat expert? If you will remember back, or go look, and if you haven't, what I discovered when I first started studying hats was that the Pope and Santa Claus both wore the same hat. And that brought me all the connections I was able to make about why they call Christmas, which is really Saturnalia, and why would Santa be wearing the same hat as the Pope? Well, because they're all the same people, right? So let's keep following my logic on this fez hat business, right? Because I don't know why the Shriners wear a fez hat, because it is such a specific hat, okay? Why would the Shriners pick that fez hat, right? Okay, so let me keep reading here. The name Fez, which is FEZ, comes from the city of Fez in Morocco, where the fezes were first made. However, it was not until the Ottoman Empire conquered North Africa that the headdress became popular among Turks. The Ottoman sultans were known for their love of luxury and exotic items. So they began importing these fezes and turbans from Morocco as a symbol of their wealth and power. The bonnet, however, did not gain as much popularity as the fez and turbans among the Ottoman elite. Fez, the national headdress of the Asiatic Moorish nation. See, now we got the Moors coming into the picture, okay? So, Fez, it is the national headdress of the Asiatic Moorish nation of, excuse me, let me start over. The national headdress of the Asiatic Moorish nation of North, South, and Central Al Morocco, which is the Americas, including the adjoining islands. The fez headdress is typically a red felt with an indigo black tassel. The fez hat is the headdress of the ancient ones, the Moabite, the Moors, also spelled Muur. Other names for fez hats are also known as Moroccan hats and Rumi topi, Rumitopi. The name Rumi topi is mainly used in Southeast Asia, meaning headwear of the Roman Byzantine. You got the Romans in the picture, right? In Arabic, fez hats were called tabush. That's that Tabooshh. Fez hats are also typical in some African countries. In Libya, a fez hat is called tachia. There is an Indonesian variation of fez hat known as peki. Who wears a fez was my question. Originally, fez hats were associated with the Ottoman Empire, but they also had a lot of religious affiliation. Both Jews and Christians of the Ottoman Empire wore fez hats. Fez hats gained popularity because they were brimless and easy to wear. This made them the ideal head covering during prayers. Fez hats are now common in some countries in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Africa. Many Arab countries request hotel and restaurant staff to wear fez hats. In Libya, fez hats are famous among the local crowd. They wear a version of fez hats without the tassel. In Southeast Asia, fez hats are prevalent among Muslims. Where did the fez hat come from? I had to ask. The origin of the fez hat is still up for debate. Many historians believe that fez hats originated from a Moroccan city with the same name. The city of Fez produces crimson berries. Crimson berries supplied red dye to color the fez hats long before synthetic dyes were available. And also, don't forget, red is the color of the Saturn people, right? Red is their color. That's why we have red for Christmas and stuff. So they're saying that it's red because of these crimson berries, okay? Some believe that the hat came from ancient Greece, while others claim that the hat arose from the Balkans. See, I gotta tell you, being a hat expert is much more complicated. But I swear to God, when I found out that the Pope was wearing the same hat as Santa, then my whole research world opened up. Okay, so I joke, but hats have become kind of a big deal in my world. Okay. A brief history. Wait. Okay. The origin of the fez hat is still up for a debate. And the crimson berries. Okay, I read that part. Okay. Some believe that the hat came from ancient Greece, while others claim that the hat arose from the Balkans. However, one thing is certain. Fez hats became famous with the expansion of the Ottoman Empire in the 1800s. A brief history of fez hats. Fez hat has a long and complex history that spans many countries in the Middle East, North Africa, and Eastern Europe. The first fez hats came in either red, white, or black. Some people wrapped turbans around the fez hats, but later on the turbans were left out. The red became the accepted color for fez hats. Because fez hats were brimless, Muslims preferred to wear them during prayers. In 1829, the Ottoman Empire ordered all its military personnel to wear fez hats instead of turbans. This added to the fez hat popularity later on. Fezes were adopted by the army units of many countries. By the 19th century, countries throughout Europe manufactured fez hats. Synthetic dyes were readily available, making it much easier to dye the hats. Wearing a fez hat became associated with high status in the US and the UK. Now, why is that? Why is it popular in the US and the UK? Gee whiz. Okay, so here we're starting to get it pick up the trail. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the fez hats went through a dark period. Oh no. Some countries even banned people from wearing them. So military use. Turkish army added fez hats to their military uniform in 1840. And they remained a part of the military attire until the early 1900s. Even today, royal guards of certain countries wear fez hats. As a symbol of belonging to a specific community, many fraternal organizations added fez hats to their uniforms. Some organizations recommend their members to wear fezes of a particular color. Few organizations even color-coded fez hats according to their rank of the members. Oh, I didn't read that right. Few organizations even color-coded. So the ranks of the members became popular in what color fez hat? The Shriners International is an example of an Arabian fraternity that adopted the fez hats as part of their official head cover. Now, why are the Shriners part of an Arabian fraternity? Oh, we'll keep asking, right? In Europe and the US, fezes gained fame because they were different from most hats out there. Yeah, I think there's another reason. Fez hats symbolize a good time and leisure in Western nations. Some call the fez hats a Turkish lounging cap. Fez hats did so well in the fashion world that they appeared in fashion magazines in Europe. Why do Moroccans wear a fez cap was my question. In Morocco, wearing a fez hat is a symbol of patriotism. Originally, Moroccan nationalists wore fez hats as an objection against the ruling French. Okay, now we got the French in here. So today, fez hats are affiliated with the Moroccan royal court. Moroccan king, cabinet ministers, and all the royal staff now wear fez hats. Today, some people view the Moroccan favoritism of fez hats as opposition to European rule, while others view it as a sign of oppression from the Ottomans. Can you wear a fez hat in Turkey? It's illegal to wear a fez in Turkey. In 1925, the first president of the Republic of Turkey banned fez hats. So, 1925, now, so right around Ottoman Empire, then we have World War I, right? We have these hats rolling around here, right? So, in 1925, the first president. When they started electing presidents, right, of the Republic of Turkey banned fez hats. Now, would you have ever guessed that a hat could be so important? He wanted to modernize Turkey and sever any ties with the Ottoman Empire. This rule was just one of many efforts to align Turkey with the modern world. Even today, wearing a fez in Turkey is illegal, but you are unlikely to face any prosecution. Well, anybody want to give it a shot? Then it went on to say some tourist hotels in Turkey are starting to revive the trend of wearing modern fezes. These hats are shorter than the original fezes and have slanting sides and black tassels. Now, why are they so hung up on this fez that they got to sneak around and come up with a new version, right? You have to ask this question, right? Do girls wear fezes? Fez hats were mainly for men, But in some cultures, girls wore fez hats as well. Fez hats have been a part of the national dress in Cyprus since the 1800s. Women wore red fez hats while men wore either black or red. So here over in Cyprus, 1800s, we have women rocking red fez hats. Wealthy women from the Ottoman Empire wore fez hats. Women adorned their fez hats with multicolored tassels and decorated metal discs on the crown. And then there is these final thoughts. Fez hats come with a long and troublesome history. Once fez hats were a sign of high esteem and a prevalent part of the Mediterranean attire, and they even became a part of military uniforms. Unfortunately, today, fez hats are not that popular. Throughout history, fez hats went through a lot of controversies. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, fez hats dropped in popularity, and the fez ban in Turkey and Egypt didn't help the fez hats to stay afloat. But some communities didn't let go of their custom of wearing fez hats. Even today, nations like Morocco have a high reverence for fez hats. So then I was querying who wears a red fez hat? The tradition of wearing a red fez originated with the Shriners, a brotherhood that is part of Freemasonry. Shriners wear the fez as a symbol of their membership. While the red fez is strongly associated with the Shriners, it has also I can't imagine this, but I'll keep reading. It has also become a popular fashion statement for those looking to add a touch of exotic flair to their outfits. Yeah, I can't go out because I can't walk, but why don't you do this? You could order a fez hat probably from Amazon. Order yourself a fez hat and then just wear it the next time you go out. Okay, and this is interesting too. See, hats are actually, I hope I've encouraged you to start looking more carefully at hats, okay? Because, in this country, the reason they started wearing hats in the 40s was because men were being transitioned. Men, the men on the screen were all transgendered, right? So the men on the screen were actually tiny women dressed as men. So part of the reason why hats were a big craze in the 40s was because it made the tiny men look like they had a bigger head. And then the women, who were really men, wear the cropped little hats to make their heads look not quite so huge. So, yes. You will find if you ever take me up on it and get into the hat business, there's a lot to actually explore in hats. So, yeah, hats were used to distort the size of their heads. So they would hide the fact that they were transgendered. And so then what they do is then they make it a fashion thing. So then everybody starts wearing hats, right? Okay, let me keep reading. So this is interesting. The tassel that adorns the top of a fez is called a gazelle. First thing I thought about, well, gazelle was Africa, right? The gazelle not only adds an extra flair to the fez's design, but also has historical significance. It is said to represent the tail of a gazelle, a symbol of grace and speed in the cultures where the fez is worn. The gazelle adds a touch of whimsy in addition to the whimsy and tradition to the already unique and distinctive fez hat. So that tassel is called a gazelle. And when I read gazelle, first thing I thought of was Africa. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the the Shriners of that Fez hat. Some of the earliest shrine centers often chose a Moorish revival style for their temples. So right off the bat, these Shriners, they call their places temples, okay? They use a Moorish revival style for these temples, right? Architecturally notable Shriners temples include the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles. Get this, the former Mecca Temple, now called New York City Center, and used primarily as a concert hall. Newark Sympathy Hall, the landmark theater, formerly called the Mosque, in Richmond, Virginia. Let me see. That was a good one here. The temple, that was a good one. You can see they changed the name a lot of these things. Okay. The Landmark Theater, Richmond, Virginia. The Tripoli. The Tripoli Shrine Temple in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The Polly Rosenbaum Building, formerly the El Zaiba Shrine Auditorium in Phoenix. The Helena Civic Center, formerly the Algeria Shrine Temple. The Abu Ben Adam Shrine Mosque in Springfield, Missouri. They had the Murat Shrine Temple, now called the Old National Center in Indianapolis. Jeez, I don't know. The Fox Theater in Atlanta, Georgia, which was jointly built between the Atlanta Shriners and movie mogul William Fox, and the Syrian Mosque in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So yeah, I'd have to say there's a lot of mosques around and a lot of strange words that have to do with these Shriners, right? So, and I had to laugh on this one because, you know, they write their own copy for these Wikipedia pages, right? Some of them get really nasty, okay? Okay, let me read this for you without trying to laugh. The Shriners originally hosted a golf tournament in association with singer-actor Justin Timberlake called the Justin Timberlake Shriners Hospital for Children Open, a PGA Tour golf tournament played in Las Vegas, Nevada. The relationship between Timberlake and the Shriners ended in 2012 when the Shriners reported that Timberlake was interested in being involved with the organization only when television cameras were present. In July 2012, the PGA Tour and Shriners Hospital for Children announced a 5-year title sponsorship, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. The name was changed to the Shriners Hospitals for Children Open. That was the new name, okay? So they also, these Shriners, they also fund these Shriner circuses. Many Shriner centers also hold a yearly Shrine Circus as a fundraiser. The Shrine's charitable arm is the Shriners Hospital for Children, a network of 22 healthcare facilities in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. In June 1920, the Imperial, see here they have these, they even name their sessions as strange names, but let me just read it. In June 1920, the Imperial Council session voted to establish a Shriners Hospital for crippled children to treat orthopedic injuries and conditions, diseases, burns, spinal cord injuries, and birth defects, such as cleft lip and palate in children. The first hospital opened in 1922 in Shreveport, Louisiana. By the end of the decade, 13 more hospitals were operational. So they do this thing where kids could get treated for free, but let me get down to the good part here. Okay. Shriners International, formerly known as the Ancient Arabic Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine, is an American Masonic society established in 1870 and headquartered in Tampa, Florida. So Shriner International was formerly known as the Ancient Arab Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. Shriner International describes itself as a fraternity based on fun, fellowship, and the Masonic principles of brotherly love, relief, and truth. There are about 200 temples across North America, South America, Europe, and Southeast Asia. The organization founded the Shriners Hospitals for Children. The organization was previously known as Shriners North America. It was changed in 2010. Okay, yeah. Notable American Shriners include actors Mel Blanc, John Wayne, Ernest Borgnine, Roy Rogers. Remember Roy Rogers? Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, General Douglas MacArthur, and Presidents Gerald Ford and Harry Truman. They were all Shriners, okay? In 1870, there were several thousand Freemasons in Manhattan. And this is right from their Wikipedia page, okay? I really would not have the time to invest in all this fiction, right? So, in 1870, there were several thousand Freemasons in Manhattan, many of whom lunched at the Knickerbocker Cottage at a special table on the second floor. There, the idea of a new fraternity for Masons, stressing fun and fellowship, was discussed. I guess they threw in the crippled children and just kind of aside, right? Somehow, when I think of fun and fellowship, I don't think of crippled children, right? Okay. So together, William M. Fleming and William J. Florence established a separate fellowship to fulfill those ideals. So it was started directly from the same group that we're always hearing about, right? Okay, so while on tour in Marseille, France, an actor was invited to a party given by an Arab diplomat. The entertainment was a musical comedy. At its conclusion, the guests became members of a secret society. This person, Florence, this actor, took notes and drawings at his initial viewing on two other occasions, once in Algiers and once in Cairo. When he returned to New York in 1870, he showed his material to this person called William Fleming. So evidently, this actor named Florence goes to tour and takes notes about how this stuff works. Fleming created the ritual emblem and costumes. Florence and Fleming were initiated August the 13th, 1870, and they initiated 11 men on June the 16th, 1871. So this whole thing gets cooked up 1870, right? The group adopted a Middle Eastern theme and soon established temple. Although the term temple has now been replaced by shrine auditorium or shrine center. The first temple established was Mecca Temple, established at the New York City Masonic Hall on September the 26th, 1872. Fleming was the first potentate. In 1875, there were 43 Shriners in the organization. To encourage membership, the Imperial Grand Council of the Ancient Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine for North America was created at the June the 6th, 1876 meeting at the Mecca Temple. Fleming was elected as its first imperial patinet. By 1878, there were 425 members and 13 temples in 8 states, and by 1888, there were 7,210 members in 48 temples. By the imperial session held in Washington, D.C. in 1900, there were 55,000 members and 82 temples. Well, quite a big group, isn't it? So they went from, let me see here. Boy, they really blew up, didn't they? So they had an imperial session that was held in Washington, D.C. in 1900. There were 55,000 members and 82 temples. But of course, now they call the temples auditoriums and centers, right? Historically, the shrine was open to only white men. In 1893, a black counterpart to the Shriners movement, and they called it the, oh God. Okay, so 1893, they come up with a black counterpart, right? Okay, what's that counterpart called? Well, It was initiated by John G. Jones and other Prince Paul Masons, initially called the Ancient Egyptian Arabic Order Nobles Mystic Shrine of North and South America and its jurisdictions. Early in the group's histories, there was a legal conflict between the white and black orders, with a white order from Texas filing suit against a black order for infringing on white Shriners' regalia and traditions. The white order was initially successful in quashing the black temple until the ruling was overturned in appeals in 1929, protecting the right of black Shriners to continue practicing and fundraising nationwide. Boy, this is something else, right? The worldwide fraternal Shriner family counts 35,000 women's auxiliary. Oh, their primary recipients. This is where you always word the money go, right? Their primary recipients of charitable donations are made the NAACP, the National Urban League, and the UNCF and various hospitals. And so that's kind of funny that the Shriners give their money to NAACP. Maybe that was the Black Shriners. But anyway, I'll keep moving on. So, okay. In 1911, the Syria Mosque was completed in Pittsburgh and was inaugurated in 1916. So, yeah, as an example of exotic revival architecture, it was never used as a mosque, but featured religious Arabic iconography and inscriptions, partly based on the Alhambra. The architect was fascinated by its design, but criticized the insensitive and callous misuse of another religion's artistry. So, musicians have performed at the Syrian Mosque, including Bruce Springsteen, Louis Armstrong. Yeah, so they had a Ladies Oriental Shrine of North America. Boy, they really got all the groups now, didn't they? By 1938, there were 340,000 members in the United States. That year, Life magazine published photographs of these Shriners' rites. It described these Shriners as being the first in prestige, wealth, and show among secret societies, and that Shriner organizations typically include a town's most prominent citizens. So, in 2002, following the September 11 attacks, The faux Middle East practices and trappings led Shriners to be mistaken for a Muslim organization, leading to harassment and vandalism. So by 2011, Shriners removed much of the Middle Eastern theming, both locally and within broader organizations. So yeah, they say that changes included renaming the organization from Ancient Arabic Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine to Shriners International, renaming the Arabic Patrol to the Patrol, and removing the word Syria from Syria Shriners Vanity Place. So, I don't know. Sounds to me like they had to do a cleaning up, right? So, how does all this work in? What I'm going to be doing is this. I'm going to be getting back to, I think we have a pretty good idea of some background here, right? About the Moors and all this stuff. I have a lot of questions, like, why did the Moors happen to come from Spain, right? What were they doing there? Why were all those crypto Jews in Spain? You know, are these really the, and we'll have more questions when I get back with the Circassians. So let me close off this file. It'll give us a good background, because it'll be a wild ride once we get to the Circassians about what happened to those people. And they basically got dumped off into Turkey, and how and why they got dumped off is an interesting scenario. So I will get back with that. So be safe out there, and goodbye for now.